Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. We're recording live at one of our favorite venues, Bridge Books in Maboneng. And we've got a wonderful guest today whose book has been on everybody's lips for the past few months. And I'm sure you guys are excited as I am to have a really interesting conversation. I'm speaking it into being. With the author of Sorry Not Sorry, The Experiences of a Brown Woman in a White South Africa, Haji Muhammad Daji. Welcome to the Cheeky Natives.
Thanks, guys.
How are you doing, Haji?
I'm doing well. I was a bit traumatized by the Joburg traffic, but other than that, I'm fine.
Yes, so you're a baptism by fire.
Yeah.
So we've seen you've been here like for what, 3-4 days, and
yes.
You guys have. You and Rebecca, whom you're married to, have been doing book launches. How has that been?
It's been good. I did a Wiser talk at Wits I can't even remember what date it is, on Tuesday evening, which was interesting. It was nice to engage. It was a bunch of academics, so it was nice to engage in sort of a different way because they were quite theoretical and they pushed my intellect out a bit, and I just wanted to be like, guys, it's a very simple book, actually. And then last night, of course, at Love Books in Melville, it was my wife's book launch. She's got a new book called Self-Helpless, which is kind of a humorous take on self-help experiences, but it's very much a non-self-help book, which is quite funny. And then tonight I'm here, so...
No, we're excited.
Can
to
I just say that these are bagels, right? Like, I know Bae's listening, so I'm just putting it out there. It's time to write a book.
To be on the Cheeky Natives.
And be on the Cheeky Natives, right? Because did you hear that? I was at my wife's launch, and today's her launch. Levels. Levels, father, I've seen what you've done for other children.
So, Haji, obviously the title of your book is Sorry Not Sorry, Experiences of a Brown Woman in White South Africa. For someone who's listening to the podcast and, you know, wanting to make a decision about whether to buy the book or not, like, give us like a elevator. What is Sorry Not Sorry about?
So Sorry Not Sorry is a collection of essays about how I and my experience in South Africa have just become saturated and completely exhausted about apologizing for who I am, the color of my skin, my preferences when it comes to food. Like, you know, spices, for example, because white people hate spices. and yeah, that, you know, that kind of thing. Because I think, you know, in a post-democratic... So can I... Is it post-democratic?
You can say what you want. It's post-apartheid.
Post-apartheid, rather. South Africa, I think we grow up with our parents sort of teaching us that in order to survive... And indeed, in order to be successful, we kind of have to make ourselves small in this very big world where very big things are happening, like politics and race and all of that. But no one ever... And then, of course, we've got, like, you know, marketing campaigns telling us that it's a great... We're a great rainbow nation. And we're actually not, because the whole rainbow nation ideology serves white people more than it serves people of color, right? And it creates a peaceful space for them to exist in. But no one ever teaches us, as young people of colour, how to have those conversations. And so I guess it's a collection of essays where I'm kind of grappling and also learning how to assert those conversations.
So naturally we want you to read, you know, give it people a taste of what's happening in the book.
Sure.
Would you do the honours?
So for those of you who do have your Bible here... Please turn to the chapter on Begging to be White on page 37, and Haji will begin reading from the last paragraph. If you don't have your book here, I hope you have lots of FOMO and you're going to buy your book afterwards.
Okay, so this is from a chapter called Begging to be White. Sorry, just to preface, so an excerpt of this was published in the Daily Maverick and I think some other publications. And, I mean, it's a very honest essay, but it's also quite humorous. And I had white people sending me screen grabs and pictures of their spice drawers to prove that they indeed knew what spices were. And I'm just like, guys, you've completely missed the point. But anyway. In her book, Americana, Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie writes about the difference in racial awareness between white people and black people. Race doesn't really exist for you because it has never been a barrier. Black folks don't have that choice. There is so much truth in this. When last did you live a day without thinking about the color of your skin and how you would be treated because of it at any moment? This is not a comment on a lack of pride or ownership of identity. Just because this awareness lingers in the back of our minds does not mean we're not proud of who we are. Now, how many times a day would you think about the color of your skin if you were white? Never. I often wonder what it would feel like to move through the world as a white person. Actually, that's a lie. I know what it would feel like. Easy. It would be so simple. The rules would be my own. The consequences of my actions, minimal. My ambitions would be my own as well. They would not be a product of this incessant need to prove myself. I could have as little or as much ambition as I wanted. I would owe the world nothing, yet benefit from the hard work of everyone else. I would carry great pride and no guilt, entitled to a fundamental right. That right would be power, an embedded kind of power. Its existence established long before my grand entry into the world, its endurance seemingly eternal. I would be as negligent as I wanted, bathe in my own ignorance, and have little to complain about, but complain nonetheless, just because I could. Now, isn't that a charming little universe?
What a way to start.
For me, begging to be white was probably one of my more favorite chapters in the book, because I was just, I was cracking myself the whole way. And the part where you talk about white people and spices,
yes,
that was my favorite. Because I think the idea of, like, you know, going to a restaurant and, you know, you're ordering the steak and you're like, it's going to be juicy, and it just comes out and it just doesn't have the right amount of seasoning.
Yes, but also it's like more than that, right? So I've been in the situation before, as my brother, as my sister, which were direct points of reference for that statement, where they've had, like, neighbors or whatever, and they're busy cooking, and neighbors complain, and they're like, so my brother had this neighbor who lived below him, and he lived upstairs, and him and his wife were cooking, like, I don't know, some chicken or something, and she complained, and she was like, if you're going to cook your food, please close your windows, because I can't stand the smell. And, you know, the broader opinion on this is literally, she was a German woman, but more than that, so colonialism works this way. You travel the world, you, like, literally obliterate people and countries, yeah. You separate them, you conquer and divide, and then you basically make money off things like spices and trade and fabric and, like, you know, whatever, and textiles. So basically white people, generations long, have gone around the world, stolen spices, exported them, made money off them, capitalized on them, and swapped them for smallpox blankets. You know, that's how they paid for them. And now they're all, like, offended. They're like, oh, why are you using masala, babes? Like, it's like, maybe you should try it.
But it's also a commentary on how people who have privilege seem to believe that the way that they do things should be the benchmark in which things are done. So because she didn't cook with spices, or she just was a salt and pepper kind of person, I guess, she felt that that was the standard at which everybody else should be judged according to, right? So anybody who deviates from that norm is then offensive, right? And then you can come to me and tell me to close my windows of my house when I'm cooking my dinner, because you don't like how it smells in your house.
And also the assumption that, you know, your food. So there's this othering in, like, okay, so you're making your food as if, you know, it isn't food. Like, no. The food that we make is the standard of food. But when you're going to use your masala, please, like, we don't want to smell any of that.
Yes, exactly. And that is, like, so perpetuated. Because, okay, for example, my wife and I are really into the show at the moment called My Kitchen Rules. we're obsessed. And there were these two wonderful contestants called Minnie and T, two black girls from KZN. And they were actually, like, our favorite. And they raised this very good point. So My Kitchen Rules is basically, like, you host a dinner at your house and you got to cook, like, this gourmet three-course meal. And then your guests, who are other contestants, eat, but then there are two judges who judge the food. And then the contestants judge the food as well. And they were all judging it according to these Western norms. So basically, Mina and he raised this point to say, you know, it's such bullshit that gourmet food can only be Western food. Like, why does it have to be French cuisine or Italian cuisine? You know, why can't we base our judgment of cuisine food on our Africanness, mm-hmm. for example, or even our Indianness or whatever. And yeah, so that's a very good point, and extends beyond that, like norms of beauty, for example.
Mm-hmm. The sexiest women are all white.
So why would you, in the book, you continue to, in that essay, which I just loved, you said you'd always want to speak to the owner. You'd always ask to speak to
the manager.
To the manager, yes. The manager. Why would you always want to speak to the manager? Because, I mean, Letlokonol and I always have this conversation about the difficulties of people of color in complaining. We struggle to complain, right? You'll complain to your friend, like, yeah, I'm never going back there. But you feel some type of way about calling the manager. Oh, my God, like, it has to be a crisis for the manager to be called. Like, the world needs to have stopped.
Yeah. So I think, you know, this is so important because, again, it comes to, like, a language thing, right? Because we go through our whole lives, generations, like, the cellular memory of, like, not saying anything. Because, like, previously you get punished, and now we're just dumbstruck by the whole thing. And so we go home and we're like, oh, you know what? I should have told that person, that white person. I should have said, instead of a brain, you have a cash register, and instead of a heart, you have a bottom line. But, like, you know, we don't say that, and we go home and we think about it. I mean, it's true, right? And, I mean, who has ever seen, like, the performance of, like, a white lady in, like, a store? Like, it's a lot. They're like, oh, I need to see your manager. This is, you know, like, not good. And, like, you can't handle the service. And so when I reference that in the book, I go through, and I don't know if this has happened to anyone else, but I, for example, walk into a store, even if it's Dis-Chem, right? And depending on which aisle I'm in, and I'm referring specifically to, like, a perfume aisle, for example, where those are high-end goods, I'm hounded by white salespeople, you know, or they'll follow me around
the
store.
This is truly only in Cape Town, I must say.
This has happened to me in Joburg several times. Referring to Rosebank now in specific.
Okay.
I've been followed around a store and completely hounded as if, like, I don't belong there, or as if, like, my money is not good enough. And then I do this thing where, like, I overspend.
Yeah.
Right?
So to show that you've got the money, give me that.
So I'm like, you know what? I don't actually just want the Dolce & Gabbana. I want that. I want the Armani. I want the Versace. And I want, you know, because just because I want to be like, I actually deserve to be here, and I'm going to show you that you are just a salesperson. And I can afford the goods. Which is actually wrong and detrimental. Like, we shouldn't have to do that. Like, white people don't have to do that. If white people find themselves in a circumstance where they are hounded by sales assistants or, like, whatever, they'll complain about it, and then they'll probably get the perfume for free or something.
But you will spend and buy.
Yeah, or you'll be followed around, like, the store. I never ever understand that, right? It's like, if I was going to steal anything at Dis-Chem, it wouldn't be cotton wool. Like, I'm so confused. Why are you following me around in the cotton wool aisle, right? And it always happens. I actually did a social experiment the other day. I went to the store. I was wearing my scrubs that have doctor in big, bold letters, right? I mean, you know, you're supposed to be the noble profession, you know? Did the security guard not follow me from one end of the store to the other? And I was like, bro, if you collapse, I'm the one person who can help you.
Exactly.
Maybe don't harass me. Like, maybe as a start. And then you have this conversation with, like, your white counterparts, and they totally cannot understand what you're talking about, right? And it's just even that replication of those systems, because the security guard who's doing that to you is black. Like, it's a person of color. And he still has such a high index of suspicion. Like, there was like a tweet the other day about how these boys went in and they robbed a grocery store, but they were really smart. So they had their white friends come with them, and their white friends stole. And the security guard was so busy following the black boys around, he didn't notice that the white boys were stealing. And is that not a commentary on the state of blackness? And this was in the US, so it's just like the state of blackness university that we're constantly having to prove and affirm ourselves. And sometimes it's unconscious. So you go to the store, you probably didn't want to buy those shoes, you just wanted to ask how much they cost, but the sales assistant was so snooty that you're actually like, can I have the black and blue?
Yes, exactly.
Haji, in the chapter that opens the book is a really interesting chapter. I think I particularly like the line where you say, and the cherry on top of the vanilla cake is that they also write those soul sensitive stuff, you know. And I suppose for me, it brought the we remember this whole big thing that happened last year when Bonang's book was apparently, you know, there was something wrong and Exclusive Books pulled it out. And the conversation that people were having on Twitter was obviously on the social capital that Bonang has. She's like a capital, you know, she's just this brand. Why would you do that? But I thought your essay was a really good segue into thinking about like how much room we've afforded white men in literature in the world, right? And I wanted to know, why was it important for you to start the book like that, to start the book with that particular essay?
So I think that essay is a good foundation for the rest of the book, where I actually go ahead and do write what I like, right? But I do think the rest of the book and writing what I like needed to be prefaced by the constraints of an internal publishing and media industry that the outside public is not aware of. Like, not a lot of people who don't work in journalism or who don't work in publishing and media know what the white capitalist economy is like within it, and they don't understand those constraints for women of color. I'm referring to myself here, who work in that, and the barriers we have to cross and the struggles we have to go through in order to have bylines and like our work published, etc. And so I did see having the opportunity to write this book as a huge advantage in order to just like go boss, you know. I just kind of like went wild, and not in a way where I was seeking to be. You know, people have this thing where they're like, oh, you wrote this controversial book. And I'm like, no, you must separate this idea of controversy from truth. Mm-hmm. Because the truth is not controversial. Mm-hmm. The truth is just truth. It's just because, you know, you're looking at it that way because it offends you. And so it was a good starting point for me to go into that and sort of use it as a platform to educate the general public of what the internal workings are. But also as a meditation for myself to not come to peace with that, but to highlight what those things were for me and then use it as a starting point for the rest of the book.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
So we often have this conversation about how we feel that women, people of color, particularly women of color, are not really allowed sort of the range to express themselves fully, right? So you need to speak about serious issues, you need to, you know, or you're not taking into account the seriousness of the black condition in South Africa at the time, right? And there's a piece that you write about in that essay where you talk about how you wrote about your trip to India, and it was just this beautiful, amazing piece, and then you didn't get it published. So looking back, how would you have handled that a little bit differently? Do you think that you would have pushed harder to get it published? Why was it important to include that particular essay? Because you contrasted that beautiful piece that you wrote about India that was layered and it was well thought out and all of this, and then there was a white man who wrote really what could have been a travel guide and got published in numerous spaces.
So like that happens all the time, right? And that continues to happen. So the piece that I wrote in India was after a holiday in India, and so my mom's Indian and her family's from India, and they've never been back, and like, you know, because they came here as indentured laborers, and there's this whole weird history. And like my mom's grandmother, for example, Chema always laughs about the story, but it's actually so sad. So she came here on a ship, no? And then she was separated from her family. So some of her family went to Mozambique. And she came to South Africa, and she was like all alone and stuff. But she had no idea, because they just like took her, so she had no idea where she was in the world and where they were in the world. And honestly, it was just next door. And she died not knowing like where her family was and like whatever. And then years and years later, like in the 90s, some nephew of hers came over and was able to find you know, cousins or like whatever on this side, because obviously she got married and they had kids and those people had kids, and they were like, where have you been? And they were literally like, we were in Maputo. It was like
just
shot left. It was just there. And like, I'm always just like, oh shame, this woman lived like her whole life and her family was next door. You know? And it's terrible and it's so sad, but also like, I don't know why I laughed. It's a comedy of errors, basically, right? And I think a lot of the therapy behind it is being able to laugh about these things. Anyway, and so going back was kind of like a pilgrimage almost. It was like this journey of like going back to this home that, you know, generations of our family had left, and they didn't even know where it was on the map, and they didn't know where they were on the map, and you get this opportunity and you go back. And I went back as a citizen because, like, years later, India invited people who could prove that they had ancestors from India to apply for overseas citizenship. So we were allowed to do that because we could prove that my mom's family was from there. And it was just so nice and so moving, and so I wrote this piece, and everyone was like, oh, like, we want to publish this. And, like, years later, I saw this piece by this, like, white man, and in the experience of being in the media for so long, I realized that whenever I write something nice, or whenever I have a nice experience, or whenever, like, I want to write something meaningful or beautiful, like, you know, in a nice, you know, fragrant kind of way, no one is interested. Because nice things are almost reserved to white people. You know, only white people are allowed to write about those things, because if I write about a beautiful holiday or nice hotel room, I always get these questions thrown back at me to be like, oh, so you don't really struggle. Oh, so like, you know, you went to a white school. So like, what's your problem? You know, and it's almost like I need permission from white people to be able to have those things and enjoy those things. And they don't understand it. And it's the same in the media industry. They have no understanding for it. And I think it's bullshit. And so when you ask me this question now about how would I approach it differently now, I think I would have gone into a bigger and more elaborate explanation. I would have been like, okay, fine, you don't want it, but this is your problem. And I would have... Yes, I would have
still
tried.
But I think in some ways it's still doing the work for the privileged, right? So
absolutely.
And I'm really getting tired of us having to explain our humanity, and even when we do have the qualifications to prove that, listen, I wrote this piece, like, it's great.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about the other piece that you wrote about your POC experience, and how your colleague had to write a softer, nicer, you know, Haji is... she didn't mean what
person.
She said, basically, but
yes.
She's really nice.
Yes.
But also, like, the understanding that we can't write truth,
yes.
Right? So you were writing true experiences,
yes.
But it felt like it was attacking people's privilege,
yes.
And someone else had to coddle them.
Yes, because that's what I mean when, you know, people read our truths and they read the harshness of our truths, and they're confronted with, like, the pain or whatever, the injustices and stuff. And they almost can't handle it. So then they're like, oh, no, this is, like, too controversial. Like, you're just out to, like, get us and you're being controversial and whatever the case is. When, in fact, it's just honesty. Like, these are facts, you know? And it's almost, like, easier on their ears when a white person explains it to them. And at the time, I didn't realize. Like, I just felt unsettled and I felt uncomfortable with the fact that, you know, this white colleague had to write a response to my piece and, like, explain to her people in a softer way what was happening and make it more palatable for them. And I didn't understand why I was uncomfortable about that. But it came back to this whole notion of white people can speak on behalf of us, but we can't speak on behalf of ourselves.
So speaking of that whole incident, I mean, that when your colleague then wrote the response, had me, and then I read your essay on performative whiteness, had me then thinking about what it means to be an ally, right? So I guess the question we're always asking ourselves is, how do white people then behave in ways that aren't performative, that aren't destructive to black people, right? So instead of you being given the space to speak on my behalf, how do you behave in ways that allow the space to open for me to speak for myself? So you're not performing your whiteness.
And virtue signaling.
And virtue
I'm highly allergic.
And
to.
Just that like weird savior complex that they start, yeah,
but
they
I
just
think
don't
also have, the conversation that is really important is this like separating benevolence from racism. So, like, I find that a lot of the time white people think that their benevolence excuses them from their racism. So they're
you
like,
can
oh,
be
but
a benevolent
I'm just
racist.
So, you know, my black friends.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
when
I
was, and when I was in Soweto for the 2 dates, I really experienced
yeah.
it. It's
that
it's,
whole thing
yeah.
of like, some of my best friends are black.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, no.
Or like, oh I will not allow people to do the work of interrogating my hajis. Peace makes them uncomfortable, and instead I'm going to assuage them and then write a response to show that she's actually one of the good ones. She is one of the good ones.
She meant well.
She meant well, okay? Like, but you know, sometimes it can be very emotional. So like it just comes across badly, but she's actually a very nice person.
Yeah, exactly. And oh, I've completely lost my train of thought now because I got so angry.
Oh,
yeah. I just control anger.
Or maybe not, right?
Yeah.
There's a whole, like...
Yeah. So just in terms of like answering your question, it's actually very, very simple. And I think I say this in the book, somewhere. The book was born from the statement in many ways. The way white people can be allies to people of color is just to shut the fuck up.
So, I mean...
Someone in the audience wants to...
So, why could Rebecca ever offended by you and how do you manage?
Let's ask her.
Can we take questions at the end? We'll take questions at the end and we'll give Rebecca time to formulate an answer.
From everything you were just saying in the last like 2 minutes, all I can think of is that.
She'll
get there.
Okay. So I think
to talk to
answer. I think that actually so one of my I want to say challenges in reading the book was like, okay, I'm like, yes, Haji, yes, drag the white folks. And then I'm like, there's the Bob Roll situation,
yeah.
You know, that for me was a little enraging. But then there's a marriage, right? And the marriage is the marriage with this white woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people who may read your book may feel that I can't take Haji seriously in her politics because how is she saying white people this and, you know,
right.
white people that. So I wanted to know, like, so in writing the book and in grappling with these things, because maybe there's another book coming, you know, we don't know. Haji's going to write.
My brother said the next book should be called Sorry, I'm Still Not Sorry.
I wanted to know how you manage...
To navigate
these spaces, right? So like there's a really like firm Haji in the book, right? But there's also this tenderness towards a Rebecca.
Yes.
Right. So I want to know how you merge the whiteness of a Rebecca with the Haji
yeah.
who is, you know,
yes.
there for the whites.
So I do get that question a lot, and it actually like I should have dedicated a chapter to that in the book, but I didn't. And I've since written...
I was like, I'm waiting for this chapter, and then it didn't come. I'm like, no, definitely need to ask.
And then, because I'd received so much, like, so much interrogation about it, I actually ended up writing a Sunday Times column about it, like, later, where I sort of explained all of this. I just want to start off by just, you know, just issuing a disclaimer. If you are a person of color and you marry a white person... Yeah, it's trial and error, hey? It's not one size fits all. You're probably going to have to try a few on for size until you find the right one. But that's okay. It happens with other people as well.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, I always go back to the same narrative, and that is the narrative of the system that we become victim to when we talk about how marrying outside of our own race erases our blackness or our struggle or, you know, the injustices we face. Because it doesn't. Because that's what so long historically we come from government that suppressed love across the color lines, right? We come from a government that punished people who want to love across the color lines. We come from people who have been tortured and beaten and killed because they attempted to love across the color lines. We come from colorism, where, you know, people needed to pass as white to love who they love, you know, and we judge those people, but we need to introspect on what all of that means. And so when you deny a love for, like, a person who's outside of your race, and you fall into the trap of judging something like that, you're falling into the trap of a system that was built for you. A system of apartheid, basically. But more than that, I always go back to the story of Maya Angelou, who is obviously, like, greatly respected. And while, you know, we read her for reference to so many things, and we philosophize on her thoughts and the meaning of her writing. And, you know, when you study the life and loves of Maya Angelou, you realize that Maya Angelou had three white husbands. And by the time she got around to marrying her third white husband, she had become so vocal and so prolific in the civil rights movement, and she'd become, you know, a face for the movement. She was a famous author already, and her work had been cited in so many different ways. She was best friends with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and, you know, all of that. And she went to I'll never forget, like, she went to James Baldwin, and she said, yes, James Baldwin. And she went to him and she said, you know, he's asked me to marry him, and I'm not sure what to do, and, you know. And he said, "And Maya, what's the problem? Why are you afraid?" And she said, "No, because, like, what would people think? What would people think of me as this powerful black woman who's so vocal about blackness and human rights and injustices? What will they think of me if I marry outside of my race and I marry, like, you know, a white man?" And he said to her, "You know, Maya, this isn't fear. This is cowardness. You're being a coward. Because in the fight for human rights and in the fight for human justice and in the fight of, like, recognition and equality and all of that, what people of color are saying is not that we love to hate. What people of color are actually saying is that we just love to love. We don't like being angry with you. We don't like being mad at white people. We don't like being, like, contentious and angry and all that stuff. Like, we don't like feeling that way. We actually don't like feeling that way. So if you don't want us to be cross with you, then stop just doing stupid shit. You know, it's as simple as that.
Stop being white.
Yeah. You know, stop. Not even stop being white, but stop the whiteness. You know? And we won't be mad anymore. Like, it's as simple as that.
It's also really interesting that I think that's a question that often gets asked of vocal, woke women of color who then marry outside of their race in ways that don't get questioned of black men or men of color who marry outside of their race, right? It's like no one will ever question Fanon's racial credentials, right? But if it's a woman, then the question then begins to be raised about, like, what are your credentials? And it's also the ways in which we police women's autonomy and we police who we believe women should love, right? And it speaks to this idea of the ownership that we think we hold over women that we admire, particularly black women.
But I think also it speaks about a lack of nuance in life, right? So, I mean, this interracial thing is still something that I'm going to grapple with. Watch me end up with a white person.
I see.
No. but I think also it's thinking about the nuance of, like, even James Baldwin, right? James Baldwin used to date white men, right? Yeah. And when we think about Audre Lorde, she was married to a white man and then was with a white woman. And just like white
Serena
women, right?
William.
Yeah, Serena. And it's this idea that... I think for me, like, love has a little complexities that we have to take outside of the politics, right? So sometimes I find that it's challenging for people.
The revolution is coming up.
And sometimes
I
think it's difficult for us to have a straightforward answer about, like, why we do the things we do. Because sometimes we don't ask black people who are in black relationships, hey, why are you with the problematic? Black
with the whole time.
Or with that, yeah. Like, nobody is asking them that, but sometimes we police people. But I think for me, the question, you know, needs to be raised because people who read the book might be like, oh, wait, like, can we...
No, definitely. And I think it's completely understandable why the question is raised and why people question it, you know. But I do think, I mean, coming back to the point of like woman being interrogated and made to explain, I do think it is a symptom of a patriarchal society mm-hmm. where men's blackness and men's politics, you know, and their thoughts and life and their power sort of just, you know, we assume that it just speaks for itself because mm-hmm. we grow up in communities mm-hmm. where men don't have to defend certain thoughts and they don't have to defend who they are in many ways, you know. But woman and the subtleties of being a woman and the infliction of that on society and what, you know, being a fragile little bird means, you know, it automatically means that women have to explain and they have to be molded to certain, you know, cookie-cutter versions of what society thinks they should be. And so in that way, they can be castigated for their choices and they put out there a lot more to be victimized a lot more than men. And it's the same with a woman's take on sexual freedom, for example, mm-hmm. or women's takes on sexuality, for example, mm-hmm. or women's takes on, you know, crossing the barriers of more conservative norms in terms of like, mm-hmm. do I want to have children? Do I not want to have children? What mm-hmm. are my choices? Can I choose? You know, mm-hmm. and society keeps, you know, just challenging this. And we challenging it now, society is challenging it now. But before it was a complete like dictatorship, mm-hmm. you know, it was like, we'll tell you what being a woman looks like and feels like, and you just have to abide by those norms. Mm-hmm. And now things have changed, and we have to stop, in as much as people of color as a whole need to stop explaining ourselves to white people, mm-hmm. society must stop expecting women mm-hmm. to answer certain questions as well.
Speaking of women, you have an essay about Serena Williams, who is like the greatest of all time ever. And if you don't agree, you can debate your mother.
don't at me.
Like, at your mama, because I'm not responsible for how you feel about black women being excellent. But I found it interesting that there are so many great like sportswomen or great whatever that she could have mentioned. And I mean, we're having a moment with Serena and we're standing in solidarity because that I deserve an apology is every woman of color ever in their lives. Like, every woman of color can relate to deserving an apology and not necessarily always being able to ask for it. So I'm just curious, why did you include Serena? Like, you could have included anybody. It could have been Maya, it could have been anybody. Why Serena? Why did Serena get a hold?
Because I think, like, I don't want to give the chapter away because you have to buy the book, guys, so I can eat. But if you read the book, you'll realize that I grew with Serena mm-hmm. and Serena grew with me. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest epitome and the biggest realization of that growth and our closeness in a way, I'm sure I sound like a psycho stalker, but like, my wife is nodding. But our closeness in a way is when this whole thing happened with that umpire, right? And I didn't get out of bed for 3 days because it broke me. Mm-hmm. Like, it totally broke my heart because, stop laughing at me, y'all. Because, like, you know, you see yourself in someone and you see yourself grow with someone and you see them grow with you and the influence they have in your life and the strength and the adversities they have to face and you take power from that. And to see it all sort of break down in one moment because of pre-existing entitlements and privileges, you just realize how far you've come but how little you've moved at the same time. And it was a really torturous experience for me, and I actually refused to speak about it for like a long time after that happened because I was just, as youth say, I was so shooketh.
Shooketh.
Also, I mean, I read that and I thought that it was just like the power of representation, right?
Yeah.
That like for a lot of us, Serena was the first time we were really seeing people who looked like us in these previously like white dominated sports. I mean, tennis is, you know, you go and you clap, you don't make too much noise when you're at Wimbledon, you gather yourself, you know, you're not yassing at Wimbledon. And it speaks to that kind of space that you navigate in. And I found that Serena chapter so interesting because Serena is proof that just like the way that whiteness is set up, no matter how excellent you are as a person of color, the goalposts will keep shifting, right? So now it's great, she's the greatest of all time, but she has an athletic advantage because she's so muscular, and like the goalposts just continuously shift. And I mean, for me, it also speaks to a lot of the themes that you covered in the book, right? About just like the different standards at which people of color and white people are held at, you know? So yeah. When you are, we just don't want to give away too much. You'll read the book and you'll see where we're going with this. But when you talk about like the things that when you're in high school that your white counterparts were allowed to get away with versus you, and the different standards, right? And like when you go horse riding, and you guys get given the horses that just look a little bit tired and they're ready for retirement, right? Because we can all relate to that. Like, if
no,
you...
No, I can't. I wasn't taking horse riding.
I mean, I also wasn't, but I felt it in my spirit. but it's like the ways in which excellence is not assumed of us, right? So no one will overextend themselves. Mm. For us, right? So I'm okay with your father's paying for these lessons, but I'm gonna give you the old tired horse. But like when Samantha comes, Samantha must get the prize-winning horse. But we both paid for these lessons, and maybe I'm even better than Samantha. And it's just these hoops that we're always having to
exactly. And it's through. The same in like lots of like societal contexts, like and social contexts as well. So one of the things I speak about is the treatment that people of color get with estate agents. I don't know if you've ever tried to buy an apartment.
This is why we need the land.
But it is hard work, guys. You have to do everything short of pissing in a cup and giving them a blood sample. Mm. Honestly, it is such hard work. Mm. And I came sort of like face to face with that several times, like over the phone and email. But in practical terms, when I bought my apartment in Sea Point, I went to go see it. And the woman outside did everything in her power to convince me to not buy this place. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, I have worked hard for my money. Mm-hmm. And I have the same amount of money as a white person who's going to buy this place. Mm-hmm. But somehow it's not good enough for you. Mm-hmm. Because you are purely judging me on the color of my skin. Mm-hmm. And how I don't deserve to live here regardless of how much I pay for it. Mm-hmm. And she literally went out of her way to say things. Oh, she started mildly. She was like, oh, you know, it's a like a four-floor walk-up. I was like, yes. Then she was like, you know, no one like you lives in this building. And I was like, okay. And then she was like, you know, it's a quiet building, so you can't really have like Pusa Thursdays. And then I was like, okay.
She didn't.
And then she gave me the price, and she was like, you know, it's so much and so much. Are you sure you can afford it? And I was honestly like, lady, do you want to see my bank statements? Because she was like, do you have someone to sign surety? Because, you know, we won't, like, just give it to you. And, like, mm-hmm. And I was standing there and just, like, you know, nodding and smiling in a very simple kind of, you know, simple Simon kind of way. And then the next client had arrived, because she was showing two people the apartment at the same time. And the next client that arrived was a white woman. Mm-hmm. And while I was standing there, this woman is like, this is a lovely apartment. You have to buy it. You're really fitting here. It's gorgeous. It's so good for the price. You get the balcony so big. And we got two totally different pictures. And we went up, and she took this woman by her hand and basically gave her like a royal tour of the apartment. And she just left me standing outside. And I happened to love the place, and a colleague showed up, and long story short, her colleague took me to the office to sign an offer, and she walked in and she was like, oh, Haji has just signed an offer. This woman made a U-turn and she walked out and slammed the door behind her, because she was so offended and so upset by the fact that I had gone to the extent of signing an offer for this place, which she tried so hard to make me not buy. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
One of my other favorite chapters in the book is about feminism, right? Because I think you really mm-hmm. do really important work in this chapter, but also in the chapter you wrote in Feminism Is. Mm-hmm. Some really important work about like you know, cutting people some slack in their feminism. Mm. Because I think that we've sort of created this monolithic understanding of what a woke feminist is supposed to look like without understanding the works, the things that have been built, right? Yeah. And one of the questions that I had is, like, who informs your feminism? So, yes, naturally someone will be like, Audre Lorde, but your essay alludes to, like, the women in your family have been the ones who've constructed how you've created a space for yourself in the world.
Look, that was a really hard lesson to learn, because I think my feminist influences come more from my grandfather and my dad, initially, than they do from my mom. Because my grandfather and dad were both like, you won't play tennis with the girls, you can't play as good as the boys, so you'll play with the boys. Not that the girls weren't good enough, but, you know, they were just like, and you can't do any sport you want. There isn't a sport that's isolated to only girls and one that's isolated to only boys. And this extended beyond, like, it went into all spheres, which is like in the arts and music and, you know, and cultural things and whatever. But having said that, within this cultural context, there was a certain role that my mother had to play. And that was one that was completely conservative and sort of unfeminist in a certain way. You know, like doing the dishes and being the housewife and cleaning whatever, like, you know, cooking the food and like all that kind of thing. And she was very observant of, like, my dad's rules and restrictions and very submissive in that way. And this really, really pissed me off. Because I couldn't quite make this connection about how they were raising really, really strong, opinionated women, but how my mother was, like, the complete opposite of this and had to abide by a different set of rules. And I was angry with my mother for, like, a very, very long time for all of this. Like, it just really pissed me off. Until I got to a point where I realized there isn't a cookie-cutter feminism. You know, feminism means different things and it looks like different things to different people. And the women in our lives of previous generations actually had their own kind of feminism. And to a large extent, survival is feminism. In order for women to survive in societies in previous generations, they had to abide by a different set of rules and a different set of norms, because that's how you got by. And that's how you created women who could stand up for themselves. And that's how we exist as we are today. And so there's a there's a certain degree of respect and empathy that I think we lack, because we think we woke up like this, but actually
no one woke up like this.
We didn't, yeah. We come from somewhere.
I mean, Letlokhonolo alluded to it, but I really enjoyed that essay in Feminism Is. Just because I think we're grappling with this idea that you think your granny wasn't woke because she took your grandfather's surname, right? But it's also about this idea of navigating feminism in ways that are true to ourselves, right? And also just allowing people room to express it. So sometimes a feminist can be someone who takes their partner's surname, right? Like,
exactly.
And cooks also, for their partner.
And cooks for their partner also, because it then goes to counter this idea of, like, white feminist woman that unless it's radical and you know, unless you're breaking things down or whatever, then you're not feminist, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, and I love that you referred to The Color Purple. And Seeley, who, it's just one of my favorite books, so I have to talk about The Color Purple. But when you refer to Seeley, I mean, it just also shows a maturity in your feminism, right? Because when I first read The Color Purple, I was like, what the hell is wrong with Seeley? Like, I feel really sorry for Seeley, but also Seeley could just leave him, right? Except that she can't. And what happens when she can't? And what does feminist empathy look like for women whose life choices are different to yours? And I think that those are some of the really powerful questions that you asked in that essay. What does feminist empathy look like and solidarity when it's for women whose life choices are so radically different to yours? And can you reach outside of yourself to empathize with those women? Because if you can't, then is your feminism intersectional? Then is it
exactly.
Is it woke? Is it?
Yeah, I think you know, the reason why, like, arts and creativity and, like, fiction, even in film and in writing exists, is because when we can't access things theoretically and academically, they exist to challenge us in different ways that are maybe more palatable. And I think why I use The Color Purple in the chapter about feminism in the book is because for me it was such an such an awakening and such a perfect metaphor for what intersectionalism truly looks like and what the realization of that should be. And it just kind of dawns on you through these characters that intersectionalism is about recognition, but it's also about growth. So if you haven't read or watched The Color Purple, I highly recommend that you do and look at Celie with different eyes.
I mean, you've already alluded to some of the people I would like to believe you read. So you've referred to Alice Walker, James Arthur Baldwin. So is there a book that changed your life? Like you read this book and you're like, I feel seen. Oh my gosh, like why didn't I read this earlier? Or like you constantly return to?
I always return to The God of Small Things.
And you're not doing conversation with her. How is that?
Oh, she's so lovely, guys. She's so beautiful. Like, I think, so I had dinner, we had dinner with her the night before to be on a panel with her. And honestly, it was like my life came full circle. Because I bought The Color Purple when I bought The God of Small Things from a secondhand store when I was like extremely young. And I read it almost every year. And then to have dinner with her and be on a panel with her was just like, if there is a God, he was just like, you deserve this. Like,
yes.
Let's make this, you know, let's make this happen. And when I had dinner with her, I just probably was like an idiot because I couldn't stop staring at it. It's just so beautiful. She's like, embodies everything that's like beauty, like from her mind to how she looks, except for my wife, of course, who's staring at
it's an important caveat.
Yeah. you know, she's just like this light, and and I just felt that it God, I don't even know how to explain it, but I think I always return to that book because you can apply the challenges of any taboo that she approaches in that book to almost anything in life, and it's always going to be topical in that way, and more than that, it's just beautiful writing.
So we are going to take a few questions from the audience, who I'm sure is burning. You had a question that we said we were going to answer at the end. Rebecca, do you want to answer her question? Do you want to repeat your question, please?
You're against the structural inequality and structural patriarchy and so on, but you use the word white often, and you come across as anti-white. So how does that cause any conflict between the two of you? How do you manage that?
No, if I'm honest, it actually doesn't. Like, I'd be lying if I mention an example where it has caused conflict between us. Because I think in her whiteness, Rebecca is one of the few people who is quite evolved. And that's not to say that she doesn't act overly white for my liking sometimes, because, you know, that does occur. But the conversations happen within our household where I do challenge her on those things and point out what certain things mean and how they come across and how they need to be treated with sensitivity and a little degree of introspection, and often maybe just silence. And so those conversations do happen, but they are very healthy when they happen. And it is possible. There is hope, guys.
Also, I mean, just a... maybe this comments, but... I don't necessarily think that Haji is anti-white. I think that you can be anti-whiteness as an institution and as a structural inequality that exists that continues to hold people of color back and that continues to behave in ways that are violent towards people of color without being anti-white. And I think that's an important thing for white people to understand as well, that I can have a problem with your whiteness and how that manifests in relation to me, but not be anti-white, because then, I mean, the cap, are you anti-black?
Yes. I don't know, for me, I think it's a little challenging. I mean, even, it seems like weird to say anti-white, because, like, I mean, we live in a white supremacist world, right? So everything that we live in is congregated within whiteness, right? So when you speak against racism and against, like, cishet patriarchy, you're speaking against a system of white supremacy, right? So you can be anti-white supremacy, but I don't think necessarily anti-whiteness, because, like, you exist within whiteness. Whiteness is, like, normalized in the world, actually. Is there any other questions?
He came all the way from Pretoria.
Oh, wow, that is a long way.
All the way.
Did you need a visa?
I probably do. I really, really enjoyed your book, especially the chapter about your dad. That was, I think, as a brown Muslim gay man, that like meant, I was literally in class and I was literally in tears. It was really amazing, so thank you for that. I think my question is, with regards to what you spoke about the issues that brown writers face within the publishing industry, what do you think, what is the way forward, more likely, and how we can overcome the obstacles that we currently face within the industry?
I think the first thing you can do is just to understand how the system works. Like with anything, you can't challenge anything until you know how it works. The second thing,
we apologize for the break in transmission.
So I think that's extremely important, because I think often with, and you find this a lot these days, like they people like woke Twitter and like people are very woke, but I just feel like no one reads things, you know, like you want to replace science in school because fees must fall, but then you don't know what you're going to replace it with. You know, I'm like, it's fine, you know, it's a Western subject, but then come with receipts, like replace it with something, you know. And it's the same in the media industry. Like, you have to know how something works in order to know how you're going to replace it and how you're going to challenge it and how you're going to face it. In more simple terms, I do feel like writers of color need to stop obeying the man, in a sense, because we often accept less than we deserve because we're so desperate to fit in to a certain structure. And I think we really do need to stop doing that. Adopting work for free, like, it's not worth it, and always you have to push back. And I feel quite privileged saying that, because I think I'm in a position right now where I obviously can do that, and I do that, and I often go, oh, okay, you don't like it, fuck off, like, leave it, it's okay, you know, I'll go somewhere else, and I know that someone else will take me, and that's, you know, that's a point of privilege. But I do think systemic change needs to happen, and it happens when we stop with this Uncle Tomfoolery, because there's a lot of that going on. And in as much as white people need to speak and preach to other white people, we need to start challenging our own people as well, and going, you know what, stop licking the chocolate starfish of your white publishers, because it's just not
that's a quote. That is a quote. So we'll stop licking the chocolate starfish. Listen, I'm gonna use that.
There was one more question.
Is Rebecca South African, or is she from abroad? Because I find generally white people from abroad that I've come into contact with are far more tolerant in work than South Africans that are white. And then, I had another question, and that's just fell away. Anyway, if you can answer that.
So Beck was born in Malawi. But then she's also one of the fortunate whites who has a European passport. So she has like an Irish passport as well. But she's not from Ireland. Like, she wasn't born there. But I don't think like that's an excuse. Like, I feel like, you know, we shouldn't absolve people because of where they're born and what their passport says. If you have a South African passport and you're a South African citizen, I'm sorry, I'm not going to absolve you of your racism because you don't come from a European country. You have full agency. You exist in a world where, like, fucking Google is your friend. So,
and it's free.
You know, adapt or die. Not that I'm gonna kill anyone, but adapt or die.
Sorry, the other question I just remembered was, you were saying, it sounded a little bit maybe one-sided, when you were saying you're having these conversations in your home. Is there anything that Rebecca challenges you on? Because I think it's also important for us to not generalize the whole white population. I mean, I have a lot of white friends that are very woke, as you say.
Mm.
So are those conversations more, this is actually such a personal question, I don't know if you even want to answer it, her defending herself of something that you are seeing, or does she sometimes challenge you too on a certain opinion you have?
Yeah, she does challenge me because she never keeps the place clean, and it's very hard for me to keep on tying. No, I can honestly say no, because I think even if you have, and I'm sure maybe your experience is different, but I can say that I have woke white friends, but it doesn't absolve them of their whiteness. I think the most irritating thing that woke white friends can do is virtue signal. And I'm so allergic to it. Honestly, just thinking of it gives me hives. And I think, you know, I don't think this makes my wife a weak person to say that she doesn't challenge me or try to defend her whiteness. I actually think it makes her a strong person.
Mm.
And more white people need to do that.
Mm.
Yes.
I'm judging from the title. Are you the antagonist or the protagonist?
In terms of...
You said sorry, not sorry. It's kind of confusing.
Oh, I get you. Okay. So it's a contradiction in terms, right? Because it's... yeah, it's a weird title, I guess, because the whole book is about not being sorry. But it's purposefully a contradiction because it is also a book about how I've spent a lot of my time being
sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Being outside loving time.
Yes. So, yeah.
So mine is more of like a comment than a question. Mm-hmm. It's also about the title. It's like the whole sorry, not sorry thing. My friend and I are university students, and we engage in these conversations a lot where we feel as if like our feminism and our blackness is always being questioned and being challenged by these men around us. And it's always been a battle, especially recently, of how when you speak of your opinion and you speak of like your feminism and all that, you come off as aggressive.
Mm.
And then you have to explain yourself again, like continuously having to explain yourself. And either way, you come off exhausted, like you come out of this conversation exhausted, because you're like, should I have explained myself? Like, what I said was valid.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that the title of your book is Sorry Not Sorry, because we've been growing into becoming not sorry. Like,
yes.
Not sorry for
yes.
what we are.
Yeah.
Not having to explain ourselves.
Yes. Yeah, and I think also, like, we need to, in as much as the stereotype of the angry black woman exists, we also, I don't want to say we need to appropriate that because that's, like, fucked up, but I think we need to kind of just be so what about it.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Yes, I am an angry black woman, so we'll take it or leave it. Yeah.
I mean, Audre Lorde has a beautiful essay on women and anger, right?
Mm.
And speaking about, like, of course I'm angry, like, racism is rife. And
exactly.
It's affecting me. So I think, like, in some ways, like, sure, why not be angry? Like,
yeah.
Why can't I be angry?
Yeah.
Like Zora Neale Hurston, if you keep quiet about your pain, they'll kill you and say that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, exactly.
You had a...
Yes.
That's
all. So I'm just thinking about the question around race and relationships. And my co-host on my podcast, Tiffany, asked, yeah, Haji about this as well. And so we went through it together and decided on the questions. And I think part of the reason we asked it is because a lot of the time when we have white friends, white lovers, or even feminists, because feminists are poor lesbian apparently who date men, we excuse certain aggressions, macroaggressions. And so for me, it's not a question of whiteness rubbing off on blackness, but more question of blackness then rubbing off on whiteness, because they will say, my wife is woke, my friends are woke, and so, you know, maybe it's not that bad. And I think it's a struggle between, like you're saying, white people and whiteness, and sometimes we kind of get those wires crossed. And so when I ask it, when I think about it, I think it's more of a wanting us to talk about certain things and grapple with nuance and the lives that we live, and talk about it, and not necessarily have answers, perhaps more questions, because you said you have to love the questions themselves. I think it was good. But it's more a question of then still holding the people that we love accountable.
Mm.
And so that's, I'm interested more in that conversation than in should we be loving whoever, because you love who you love, but it's, are we holding those people accountable and how are we doing this? And not excusing certain things because we love them.
Mm. I agree with that. That's a very good point.
So, sorry,
obviously,
we're gonna wrap up. But you can ask a question afterwards. She'll still be here.
Obviously, we know Haji listens to the Cheeky Natives, and obviously, you know, this is the part, the big reveal. So, you know, other people give people like popcorn or whatever
stuff
they give them, but we're serious. Like, you know, we've been dispossessed, so we're giving people land.
Mm.
You know?
Based on how much we've enjoyed your book. So we read your book and we go, meh, eh, eh. Or we go, oh my God, this is like life-changing. And based on that, the Cheeky Natives Land Committee, which consists of myself and the Tlokonolo, sits and we deliberate. And then we allocate land, right? So we have a little brilliant conference of our own. And we decided on the land that we were going to give you. So are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Are you ready?
I'm very excited.
Are you ready for the land that you're getting? So having read your book, and
I hope it's not in a zad hole or something.
We're coming for all the land. You were born to a Muslim family in the apartheid township of Lodium in Pretoria. We thought it would be appropriate to give you a piece of land
in Pretoria.
But the piece of land that we're giving you, are you ready?
Yes.
We are giving you Waterkloof.
Oh my God!
Oh, lovely. We are giving you Waterkloof in Pretoria, and you are going to go on to flourish and be all the brown girl magic that we
love
know
it.
You
I'll
to
take
be.
It, guys. The views, the weather, everything.
Listen, you can also land your plane at the airport
yes.
base. I'm
I'll
here for
it.
It.
I'll have it.
But just from the Cheeky Natives, we just want to say congratulations on having written such a powerful book. I think that this is the year of the memoir, and women of color are really, really coming through with the memoir and telling their stories in ways that are true, that aren't written for a specific gaze, but that lend truth to power, right? That
yeah.
tell truth to power and do so in ways that empower the people who are reading your stories. Because there's nothing more powerful than feeling that you are the only person in the world experiencing this, and then you read. And that's what James Baldwin said, that you think your pain is unprecedented in the world, and then you read.
Mm.
And you realize that you're not the only person who thinks Serena is the greatest of all time.
But yes, Haji, like, I think from the Cheeky Natives, really thank you for also the vulnerability with which you wrote your book and the honesty with which you wrote it. I think that some of the for me, I think what the book has done is to start creating conversations and necessary conversations about race, about love, about family, about mental health,
mm.
About queerness and religion,
mm.
and these various intersections that we find ourselves in. So thank you for that, for just being that honest and vulnerable with
mm.
these essays. And we obviously cannot wait to read whatever you write next. And
sorry,
to sit down and be like, you know what, Haji, give us again, you know, give us again the vanilla on the cherry on top of the vanilla cake. Having said that, is there anything that you're working on now, or are you just like, you know what, I'm still not taking a break?
I'm not really taking a break, so I still freelance, but I must say I've been quite lax on that. Don't know how I'm going to pay my bills next month. But no, not. I'm thinking about obviously another book, because I would like. Love to do one, but I'm still ironing out exactly what that is. Yeah,
and thank you everyone for a great audience. We will, you know, have this opportunity for book signings, book purchases, because, you know, y'all
please buy the
books,
y'all. Like, don't ask the author for a PDF. Like, I say this all the time, because this, like, foolery must stop. Like, can people do better? Please don't ask the author for a free copy. Like, books cost money to print. I don't know if somebody's told you this, but I'm going to break it to you today. Books actually cost money to print. You can't get them free. Buy a book. Please don't ask the author for a PDF. Maybe don't lend your friend's copy, go and buy a book, you know, just as a suggestion, maybe.
Support black women.
Support women of color telling their stories, right?
Amen.
Like,
totally agree.
Thank you. Yay, I've already got someone's going to buy the book in the audience. But you can use our code CHEEKY at
Bridge Books
and you can get 10% off. So we are here to help you be better people. That's what it is.
much.